Chief Judge and the judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Just one moment. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Technical Sergeant Jaime R. Rodriguez, ACM 38519. Appellant presents three issues for our consideration during arguments today. They are, first, whether the military judge reversibly erred by failing to dismiss Charge 3 and its specifications, Charge 4, Specification 1, and Second Additional Charge 1 and its specifications for unlawful command influence. Second, whether the military judge reversibly erred by failing to grant the motion to sever. Third, whether the evidence is insufficient to support a finding of guilty as to Specification 1 of Charge 3 of aggravated sexual assault by causing bodily harm to Airman First Class B.S., and Specification 2 of Charge 3 of abusive sexual contact by causing bodily harm to Airman First Class B.S. Are both sides ready to present argument?
Appellant's ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Very well. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Allred, may it please the court, good morning. My name is Michael Gross, and along with Major James, we represent the appellant in this case, Jaime Rodriguez, on this appeal from a GCM at Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio. As I said, I've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal on the case. Imagine that you've been charged with an offense. Charges have been preferred and referred against you. And it comes time for trial, yet 1 month before trial, the President of the United States has an address regarding the charges similar to what you're charged with, where he says that there's no tolerance for these charges. He expects consequences, not going to tolerate this stuff, and there will be accountability. People that are charged with these offenses will be court-martialed, fired, stripped of their duties, and dishonorably discharged. And on the same day, 1 month before your trial, the Secretary of Defense says these types of charges are incompatible with military service and will not be tolerated. And then 1 month later, you're expected to go to trial at a GCM, and all the members are familiar with either the President of the United States' statements or the SecDef's statements or Congress's investigation into those matters. And you're at Lackland Air Force Base, which, frankly, back in May of 2013 and June of 2013 was ground zero for sex assault cases regarding recruiters and applicants or MTIs and trainees. That's what we have in this case.
Mr.
And the question,
let me just pinpoint one specific area within this UCI issue that we're now addressing. It seems to me from reviewing the record that the military judge made considerable effort to cure any taint through excusals and voir dire. If I saw correctly, there were hundreds of pages in the record of trial addressing member suitability. The military judge dismissed 7 of the 17 potential jurors, if I recall correctly. And of those remaining members, the defense had no objection to any remaining member except for one. Is that correct?
The defense had a concern with Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff. That's correct,
okay,
Chief
yes.
Judge. Because Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff, he had some...
Now, maybe I'm a little confused on the name, so maybe you can help make sure that I'm not garbling things here. But I had Lieutenant Colonel H.R. was the initials that I had. Are we talking about the same person who you've got... I realize this particular assignment of error number 6, is not one set for oral argument today, but you address a claim that one individual should have been excused and was not excused by the military judge, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so kind of putting it together, are we talking about the same individual here?
No, sir.
Okay, separate individuals.
Yes, sir. That's Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Ragland.
Okay, I got
who stayed
that.
On.
Okay.
Yes, sir. In fact, the military judge, after voir dire was completed, asked defense counsel, do you want to renew your challenge on Lieutenant Colonel Ragland? They were concerned he was going to go permissive TDY. And Lieutenant Colonel Ragland said, if it goes so far into the court time, My permissive TDI might be affected if it goes into Saturday.
Okay, so let's come back to, you helped clarify that for me. Let's come back to the member that the trial defense counsel may have had some issue with at the time of trial.
Yes, sir. That was Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff. The defense challenged him for cause, and as you pointed out, Chief Judge Arad, that's exactly right. The defense said, we have a challenge for cause for Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff. He heard the president's comments from last month. You know, of course, this case is tried in June of 2013. The president's comments were in May of 2013, just the month prior. Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff said, I heard the president's comments. I heard the SecDef and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were summoned to the White House by the president over these kinds of charges, sexual assault in the military. And I heard they say that it was shameful, needs to be fixed, and that Congress was questioning the military. So, a trial defense counsel challenged Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff for cause. The trial counsel objected to the challenge for cause. The military judge denied the challenge for cause for Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff. So, the remedy that the judge was giving here, liberal jury selection, liberal challenge for cause, was not followed.
Okay, so we're talking about this Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff, there being an issue related to him. Trial defense counsel had no objection to any of the other remaining members, right?
None that he voiced.
Okay, so assuming that that the trial defense counsel had no issue with any of the remaining members by the time we got to voir dire, wouldn't any UCI taint be confined only to this Lieutenant Colonel Monninghoff, and wouldn't we only be looking at whether there was some taint related to him that might have been prejudicial? Isn't the issue really that narrow, is my question to you?
Respectfully, no, Chief Judge, and that's a great question. But, you know, when the military judge asked trial defense counsel if he wanted to withdraw his challenge for cause to Lieutenant Colonel Ragland, the military judge said, I recognize, as we all do, we've done courts martial, I recognize the numbers game is important on the one-third, two-third consideration by defense. I know you're taking that into consideration. The military judge said that. However, we don't know. We can only speculate what defense counsel was thinking about the numbers with respect to the one-third, two-third, as the military judge asked. I think that it's not solely relegated to that narrow issue, Chief Judge, because in the defense's motion to dismiss for UCI, the defense said the case shouldn't go forward at this point.
So when should it have gone forward?
Sir?
When should it have gone forward?
It should have been a liberal motion for continuance granted, Senior Judge, and here's why, sir.
When?
Well, in Biagassi, they waited a long time for the case to go forward, along with in the Douglas case, both of which cited in our briefs. The military judge gave plenty of time for that to be what he called the cleansing work to process through with the hot issues that were going on at the time. So it's our position, Your Honor, that why would we need to go to trial 1 month after these hot statements by the President of the United States and SecDef when we could have reset the case down the road as the defense requested in the motion? The military judge is the last sentinel on these cases, as the Biagassi, Douglas, and Harvey cases say. The military judge could have done some things like they did in those cases for Biagassi, for instance. The military judge, sua sponte, brought the command into the courtroom, told the command, here's my concerns about the potential UCI in this case. I want everyone to understand that no one will be in trouble for what happens in this case.
Didn't the military judge essentially do that with the members, making sure that they understood that their duty was to be a court-martial member to judge the case based on the facts presented in that court and not based on any outside influence?
He tried. And
so how did he fail? You say he tried, and it seems to imply that he did not try. He did not succeed.
And that's a great question, Senior Judge. And here's why I think he, even though he tried in good faith, he wasn't able to succeed. Most of these members had never been on a court before. And most of these members said, for instance, Colonel Stratton, he heard the president's comments. Colonel Glass, Lieutenant Colonel Ragland, all these people heard zero tolerance. We heard the president's statement, SecDef, SecNav, Secretary of the Air Force, Congress investigating it. I was racking my brain to kind of think of an analogous kind of situation. And I'll supplement this this afternoon, but there's a site, Holbrook versus Flynn, out of the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Holbrook versus Flynn at 475 U.S. 560, The court there was dealing with a death penalty issue and extreme courtroom security. And the judge tried as best he could to get the potential jurors to understand that, look, you shouldn't have to consider these things. It should have no effect on you at all. You should be able to put it aside, this heavy security in the courtroom. Supreme Court of the United States said, you know, the question's not whether these jurors actually articulated a consciousness of what might be a problem. We shouldn't be looking at what the potential jurors said, because it's unfair, because they don't know what it's going to be like when the rubber hits the road and they're hearing the evidence and then they're in deliberations and they're thinking, we need to voice our concern about whether there's sufficient evidence, for instance, in point of error 5 that I've raised.
Counsel, let me ask you about that point. The members did acquit your client of some of the charges which he pled not guilty to. Isn't that evidence that, in fact, they took their duties seriously and responsibly and weren't just swayed by outside influence, but instead evaluate the evidence based on how it was presented in court?
Actually, Senior Judge, I think it proves our point, because the only
the fact
offense
that they acquitted him proves the point that they were unlawfully committed influence to convict. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir, because what the members acquitted Jaime Rodriguez of was the only non-sex assault offense alleged in the charge sheet. The only thing he was acquitted of, the final charge, had nothing to do with any sex assault at all. Yet on point of error 5, it's our position, these three points of error, the reason I asked to orally argue these three points of error is that they're intermingled with each other. The UCI, the severance with the spillover effect on the same charges, and then the sufficiency of the evidence. You know, it was clearly not sufficient evidence on what he was convicted of under point of error 5, yet the members convicted him of it. The only thing they didn't convict him of was the very last second additional charge 2 in its specification dealing with kissing JD, nothing about the sex-related offense. So if I could segue into that.
Well, counsel, I just want to clarify here, though, too. With charge 3, specifications 1 and 2, they did convict, but convicted of lesser included offenses. So, again, let me just clarify. Your position is that does not indicate that they were independent, but instead is somehow evidence that they were, in fact, swayed by these outside influences.
Exactly right, Senior Judge, especially since what they did, the LIOs that he was convicted of dealt with non-consensual acts, sex acts. Even though it was guilty of the LIO, not guilty of the charged offense, the LIO upon which he was found guilty were sex acts. Before I leave point of error 1, if I could real briefly, you know, the government does not have any concern, apparently, in the briefing that it submitted regarding the civilian leadership making the UCI comments in this case. In fact, it appears that the government, in their brief, have not taken the military judge's findings of fact to task at all. And so it's our position that the military judge's findings of fact that he alleged, for instance, that he agreed with the facts alleged in the defense motion to suppress regarding the President of the United States statements and SecDef statements, that those statements, that those individuals, the civilian individuals, wield a mantle of authority over Air Force officers. And so the military judge found some evidence of apparent UCI. The government does not contest those findings of fact or conclusions of law by the military judge. And the military judge found a logical relationship between those statements and this case on finding of fact 47 in the military judge's findings of fact. It's our position that at that point, then, under the Allen case cited by us in our brief, there's now a presumption of prejudice. And the government bears this additional burden of rebutting the presumption that Jaime Rodriguez was deprived of a fair trial. There's a presumption they have to rebut, and they didn't even try to do that in their brief. In fact, in their brief, they didn't even address apparent UCI, which is our allegation in the case. So it's our position that there was UCI in this case, and the defense motion to dismiss should have been granted.
Counsel, while we're on that point, let me ask you, are there findings of fact that you feel or that you contend are clearly erroneous?
No, sir. The military judge was spot on all findings of fact. With regard to conclusions of law, The only concern we have was the final conclusions of law where the military judge did not conclude, well, where he concluded that it would not prejudice proceedings or not affect the findings and sentence. That's the only conclusion of law upon which we have a concern with senior judge on the military judge's findings of fact. Now, with the severance, the spillover effect is what we were concerned with, and that's why I wanted to just briefly touch on point of error four, because the spillover effect on these charges in this whole case is in the light of the all charges in this case is of concern, especially under the Southworth case with the prongs to be looked at, where the military judge has to determine if the evidence itself strongly suggests spillover, such as when a strongly supported allegation is joined with a weakly supported one. And that's what we have here, because this point of error segues from that right into point of error five with the sufficiency of evidence of charge three and specifications one and two of charge three, because frankly, in that case, in these two charges, the complainant in this case for these two charges said, you know, I allowed this to happen. And that's at page 869 of the trial record. She allowed it to happen, what was alleged in specification one, the touching of the genitalia. That she engaged in foreplay while these acts happened at pages 906 and 917 of the record of trial.
Counsel, let me ask you, didn't the military judge also find that the issues that you say should have been severed would have been still admissible, even if they had been severed, would have still been admissible in the separate court-martials under 413?
He did, Your Honor, and that was prong one of Southworth. That's correct. But prong two is what we have concern with under Southworth, because under prong two, the military judge had to determine if the evidence itself strongly suggests spillover, as when a strongly supported allegation is joined with a weakly supported one. So I agree with you, Senior Judge. The military judge is correct on the first prong. Would the evidence of one offense be admissible proof of the other? It's the second prong of which we have concern in this case, especially in light of point of error five, dealing with sufficiency of the evidence of charge three and its two specifications. And so with point of error five, our concern is that since there's kissing going on during all of this, which is pages 907 and 909, since BS allowed this to happen, as stated at page 869 of the record and at 873 of the record, and again under spec 2 of charge 3, she again says there's kissing while all this was going on at page 909.
Counsel, it sounds to me like you're arguing factual sufficiency. Are you also, do you contend that the charges and specifications are not legally sufficient? And if so, how?
Great question, Senior Judge, and thanks for pointing that out. You're correct. So I'm doing both factual sufficiency and legal sufficiency. And the legal sufficiency goes to the consent defense and the mistake of fact defense, both of which were given to the members by the military judge, both consent and mistake of fact. And it's our position that the finding of guilt for these two specs of charge three are also legally insufficient, given those instructions given to the members by the military judge regarding consent and mistake of fact. Given those two together, the evidence is legally insufficient, especially under Jackson versus Virginia, and also factually insufficient, given the fact that also under spec two of charge three, BS indicated what she was doing while this was going on, like on page 911, moving her hand, the touching. Those types of things indicate consent and also would give anybody, a reasonable person, a mistake of fact offense legally and factually. The government in their brief at page 24, they do cite where BS stated no, no, no on the record. However, the no, no, no statements alleged by the government at page 24 of their brief do not have anything to do with specs 1 and 2 of charge 3. They had something to do with the alleged oral sex, not with the touching of the genitalia of either BS or the appellant. So it's our position, Your Honor, that, Your Honors, that given this whole effect between the UCI, the court-martial members having heard all these statements by the President SecDef, the spillover effect under prong two of Southworth under point of error four, and the sufficiency of the evidence problem both legally and factually with point of error five, we've got this cumulative effect of error in this case that we think should allow Jaime Rodriguez a new trial in this case. I see my time's up. If there are any other questions, I was going to sit down.
Thank you. You may. Thank you. Major Gaming, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. I'm Major Jeremy Gaiman. Together with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge was correct in finding that beyond a reasonable doubt, there was no possible UCI would impact the trial, and appellant on appeal has not provided any additional evidence or argument as to why this finding should be questioned by this court. This court also should be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that specifications 1 and 2 of the additional charge 3 are legally and factually sufficient. And the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied appellant's motion to sever the charges at trial. But first, in discussion of UCI, the standard review at this court is where, as here, the issue was litigated on record at trial. The military judge's findings of fact are reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard. But the question of command influence flowing from those facts is a question of law that this court reviews de novo. At trial, the defense has to raise some facts, if true, that constitute UCI, more than mere allegation and speculation, and that that alleged UCI has a logical connection to the court-martial. If defense meets that burden, then the government must prove the predicate facts do not exist, do not constitute UCI, or that UCI will not prejudice the proceedings or affects the finding of sentence.
Counsel, let me ask you, are any of the military judge's findings of fact on the UCI clearly erroneous, in your opinion?
No, Your Honor. The government only take contention with whether or not those facts actually constitute UCI. So in other words, are they flowing, does UCI flow from those findings? Specifically with the judge's findings that there was a logical connection between the statements made and the connection with the accused, with the appellant's court-martial. But at this trial and on appeal, we are not concerned with actual UCI, but with apparent UCI. The military judge found that there was not actual UCI. There was no evidence that anyone attempted to affect the court-martial. Defense never argued actual UCI, but this was all based on apparent UCI. And that is an objective standard. Viewed to the eyes of a reasonable member of the public, an appearance of unlawful command influence exists where an objective, disinterested observer fully informed of all the facts and circumstances, so they have to know everything, would harbor a significant doubt about the fairness. So it's not just a doubt about the fairness, it has to be a significant doubt as well. And in this court, as well as the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces, has sometimes skipped the analysis of whether the appellant has met his burden, his initial burden, and whether that shift to the government or not, without making a finding. The court just looks to see whether or not the UCI actually prejudiced the proceedings, whether it was actually unfairness. So without deciding whether the appellant met his burden, without deciding whether there's logical connection, the court immediately looks to, was this court-martial unfair? Did UCI, either apparent or actual, impact the fairness of this court-martial? And kind of skips some of the UCI analysis, some of the tests, to get down to what really matters, was the trial unfair in any respect? And the only way the trial could possibly be unfair had to do solely with the members, as argued at trial as well as here on appeal. It solely dealt with the members. And as this court noted, of the 11 original members, only 4 remained of those individuals. And then a new panel was brought in of 6 members, and of those 6, another 4 remained. In fact, the defense had no objection at trial to the new panel. And of the 4 from the original panel, defense had challenged only one of them that had remained. And that is Lieutenant Colonel R. And so it's through Lieutenant Colonel R, really, is whether or not there was an apparent UCI. And through his voir dire, there was nothing.
And you say Lieutenant Colonel R, but I thought I walked, maybe we'll sort this out afterwards, but it seems to be at odds with the discussion I just had with Mr. Gross, but as to who the individual in question is, but go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. There were two individuals that were challenged, three individuals specifically challenged by defense in the initial voir dire. It was Lieutenant Colonel M, Lieutenant Colonel R, and then Lieutenant Colonel N. Lieutenant Colonel N, the government conceded that he should be excused for cause. Lieutenant Colonel M was then challenged peremptory by the defense, and so he was removed. So the remaining member on the panel was Lieutenant Colonel R. And then looking specifically at Lieutenant Colonel R, the judge found that though he was somewhat...
I'm sorry to belabor this, but is that the same Lieutenant Colonel R that is the subject of the assignment of error number 8 or whatever
that
it
is? That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And you'll note that in that assignment of error, discussion on the record as well, that Lieutenant Colonel R was not influenced. He did not feel pressure by it. In fact, he noted that he attempted to avoid media contact because of he knew that he was on the panel. There was nothing about his review and understanding of the general idea of sexual assault in the publicity that influenced him in any way. Nobody tried to pressure him, so obviously there was no actual UCI, but he did not take or perceive any of it to be UCI. There was nothing directive that he took. And the military judge found that, discussed that on the record, and did not excuse. So there was no apparent UCI because any disinterested observer, fully aware of all the facts and circumstances of Lieutenant Colonel R and his voir dire process, nobody would believe that UCI had affected the proceedings or the fairness of the proceeding. And this court can just look at the prejudice there because even when panel members have been exposed to comments suggested of unlawful command influence construct, an accused can receive a fair trial where there is, one, full disclosure of the matter on the record, two, an assessment of the member's ability to render an impartial judgment, and three, proper instruction in the member's judicial duty. The parties and the military judge had the burden to fully question the court members during voir dire to determine whether a member's comments had an adverse impact on the member's ability to render impartial judgment. And that was discussed at length in Reed. And also, and this is not in the briefs, Your Honor, but the court cited that language in Reed recently in 2015 in United States versus Dundon, 2015 CCA Lexus 74. So the military judge was correct that beyond a reasonable doubt, UCI had no effect on the appellate's court-martial, and there's no evidence of it on the record, Your Honor. I'd like to talk about factual and legal sufficiency that's been raised as to Specification 1 and 2 of Charge 2 regarding A1CS. The test for factual sufficiency is weighing the evidence on the record and making allowances for not having personally observed the witnesses. We ourselves of this court are convinced the accused is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And the test for legal sufficiency is whether considering the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational or sometimes the court describes it as a reasonable trier of fact or fact finder, could have found all the essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court is to draw, or bound to draw, every reasonable inference from the evidence of the record in favor of the prosecution. And in this case, the court is aware of the kind of the general facts where we're talking about an individual who was the appellant, who was a recruiter. He was the supervisor of A1CS. She worked underneath him, and he was responsible for signing her paperwork for her to be able to be a part of this recruiter assistance program. In other words, be able to spend 2 weeks at her hometown with her family and not have to take those 2 weeks of leave. This was the circumstances surrounding her interaction with the appellant in this case. She was 20 years old at the time and brand new to the Air Force, had just finished technical training school.
Major Gaiman, the accused or the appellant was not charged with using his rank or position to obtain the sexual activity or favors in question. To what degree is that relevant to our discussion here? And to what degree, and kind of along with that, is to what degree are his rank and position important in determining whether the elements were met here?
Yes, Your Honor. And looking at the definition of consent in the MCM, it talks about taking into consideration all the surrounding circumstances that are involved. And this also goes to her actions that she was taking in those specific, in that specific instance of how she would react, why she would react that way, and the level of, if you will, lack of consent she would display in those circumstances. So you are to consider all the surrounding circumstances when considering consent and whether an individual consented or not, and the relationship between the two, a supervisory relationship, and the age and naivete of the victim as well as should be considered in understanding why she reacted the way she did and how she reacted, and also for the accused perspective as well in the situation as well, knowing who she is and who he is in that relationship. And to get right to the issue, consent requires some type of words or overt act indicating a freely given agreement. An expression of lack of consent through words or conduct means there is no consent. She pushed his hand away numerous times, and yet he persisted. He grabbed her hand and put it on his penis numerous times, and she kept removing it. That is an overt act that shows non-consent. And you'll note that the record is empty with regard to anything in the overt act or word from her that changed in between when she was withdrawing her hand, with pushing his hand away, and withdrawing. There was nothing that changed there. She didn't tell the accused, okay, this time you can do it, on either occasion. Nor did the accused ask, can I do it this time? Nor did she change anything about her behavior or her conduct that would suggest to the accused. There is nothing in the record to suggest that. So nothing changed. All you have is an accused.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. You're saying nothing changed, and there was no verbal consent. But what should this court make of the fact that she's kissing him during the actus reus of his touching of her genitalia? Doesn't she indicate that the kissing is consensual, that they were, I believe her words were, making out prior to that, and
yes,
that she continues to kiss him and hold on to him while he is touching her? Isn't that the nonverbal indication of consent?
Your Honor, that would imply then that any time you're kissing an individual or maybe holding them while you're kissing, that any conduct beyond that would be okay. Just because you're engaging in one consensual act doesn't mean you have therefore consented to every act beyond that.
Let me just kind of follow up with what Senior Judge Mitchell discussed here. And at a minimum, wouldn't we agree that that Airman First Class S was conveying a number of mixed signals in that setting? Don't we have a lot of text messages in which they've talked about things like sex in that very context and how she'd be willing to have that? Isn't that going on in the background?
Prior to the incident, yes.
Okay, and then there's kissing and other things going on that might, at a minimum, convey a mixed message. And just following up here, as I see it, and you can correct me on the assessment here, but we've really got three sexual events. We've got digital penetration, oral sex, and then sexual intercourse, which never actually occurs, right? Okay, we've got those three events. And isn't it true that when she actually becomes rather strong in her indication that she doesn't want sex, phase three, sexual intercourse, that he quits, and that's the end of it. It didn't require physical violence from her. She didn't need to push him away. She just said, really, really, no, and I'm leaving, and that ended it. Doesn't that suggest that when she truly manifested her consent, he was willing to go along, or her lack of consent, when it was truly clear that he was willing to honor that?
No, Your Honor. If anything, all that displays is that at some point, she decided that she had to get out of the situation because he was never going to stop. And she states very clearly on the records that this is something, the sexual intercourse was something she could not live with. She could live with him, you know, touching her without her consent. She could live with him grabbing her hand and putting it on his penis without her consent. And she could live with the fact that he performed oral sex without her consent. But she could not live with the fact that he was going to try to have sexual relations, intercourse with her at that point in time. And so she spoke more firmly and got up to leave that point. It doesn't show she consented in the previous encounters. It merely shows that she had to, at that point, be more firm and more aggressive and get away from him because she realized he was never going to stop. Her words and her actions weren't stopping him, and the only way to make that not happen was to actually be more forceful and leave. And that goes back to the surrounding circumstances and understanding who she is and who he is in the relationship and why maybe she has this kind of graduated scale of how much she needs to do to get away, because it puts her status of being part of the RAP program in question, or at least makes her nervous, as well as the fact that he's an NCO. He's a married NCO, and she's a new recruit to the United States Air Force. And there's actually some great language in the Ayers case, which was cited for purposes of UCI, but it also talked about some legal and factual sufficiency regarding an NCO and a young airman. And in the dissenting opinion, Judge Crawford stated that he considered the rank, the age, position, and disparity, the marriage of the NCO and training, and stated that when a paramour persists in engaging in the same conduct that has been explicitly rejected, their paramour has crossed the line. And that's identical to this situation. You have the appellant who keeps persisting in that behavior, and she has pushed him away, she has told him no, and she has removed her hand several times, and he keeps persisting in that behavior. And her giving up because it's not working isn't consent. It merely shows that the paramour, the appellant, has crossed the line.
Finally, along with that, though, when I talk about her testimony where she says that he moved her hand to his penis and that she removed it several times, but then during the cross-exam, she does state that at some point she continued to hold on to his penis and she moved her hand in an up-and-down fashion and that he wasn't forcing her to do that. And he was not holding on to her hand at that point. What should this court make of that testimony in terms of whether that's a nonverbal indication of consent?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the progression, though, that was at the end of things. So he had tried, he had grabbed her hand and put it on his penis. She had pulled it away. He tried again. She pulled it away. She tried again. It pulled it away. This went on for a couple of times. And then one of the times, the final time, is she left it on his penis. Her actions up to then were, don't do this. She pulls it away. Don't do this. She pulls it away. Don't do this. Pulls it away. The fact that she just held on that last time just shows that in that situation, obviously there was pressure. I mean, he kept trying to increase the contact. He starts by digital penetration. He has oral sex. And then he tries putting her hand in his penis. And then he tries sexual intercourse. So there is an increased pressure, if you will. And her testimony consistently was, he wouldn't stop. Every time, at the very end, I believe this was on redirect examination, every time I pulled away or told him no, he just kept not stopping. He wouldn't stop. It didn't matter what I did. So this is purely shows that she was in the position of, this isn't going to stop. I have to do something to make this stop, and this isn't going to stop. So she finally just kind of gave up in each of the situations. And that, in that situation, Your Honor, would be her giving up. This is going to happen whether I want it or not to happen. And so that's her giving up.
Can she consent to sexual activity that she earlier declined?
Yes, Your Honor. An individual can say no and then later on say yes. But you'd have to look at all the surrounding circumstances of whether that was actually words or overt act indicating a freely given agreement. So it's not just an agreement. It's not just a change of mind, but it has to be a freely given agreement. So you would look at the surrounding circumstances to see whether that was actually a freely given agreement in that circumstance when this 20-year-old girl was with a married technical sergeant, her supervisor at the time. You can also consider, as the trial court did as well, the fact that there was 413 evidence involved. And the similarity in that occurrence with Miss J.D., it happened in the recruiting office. He locked the doors. She was a new recruit, a young girl. He has her come to the back room. He tries to kiss her, and he tries to make her touch his penis. In eerily similar events, and even though Miss J.D. says no, she pushes him away and moves away, he is still persistent in his behavior as well. She is literally leaving the room or trying to leave the room, and he grabs her hand, pulls her back, and puts her hand on his penis. And that's something this court should consider, too, in evaluating the pressure that A1CS felt and her consent and the way she comported herself during that encounter with the appellant. If there are no further questions about legal and factual sufficiency, I'll move on to the issue of severance. This court reviews a military judge.
I'm sorry. I do have an additional question.
Absolutely.
And that is, as your opposing counsel indicated, that her verbal manifestation of lack of consent when she said no was to the oral sex, of which the members acquitted him of forcible sodomy and convicted him only of consensual sodomy. United States versus Walters, 58 MJ 391, at page 395, Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, 2003, states that a court of criminal appeals cannot find as fact any allegation in a specification for which the fact finder below has found the accused not guilty. So how does that influence whether we can consider if she said no or that she said no in making the determination as to these other sexual assault offenses?
Obviously, this court is uncertain what specifically the members relied on in making that determination, but this court can consider under factual and legal sufficiency the entire record, and that includes all evidence that was introduced at trial. And even if perhaps the members didn't rely, if we're going to go so far, maybe not relying on specific statements by her, it's still part of the record for you to review under Article 66. Factual and legal sufficiency. And it also provides context to the facts and circumstances of the incident as it was occurring. So in other words, it shows the appellant's state of mind, it shows her actions and how she was acting and her lack of consent throughout the interaction with the appellant. And so, yes, it could still be considered by this court, should be considered, and while it may not speak directly to some of the other conduct, it does show what she was doing and perhaps explains why she reacted the way she did in relaying her non-consent to the appellant. With regard to severance, military judge's decision to deny severance is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. If a motion has been denied, the appellant must demonstrate more than the fact that separate trials would have provided a better opportunity for acquittal. The appellant must show that the ruling caused actual prejudice by preventing the appellant from receiving a fair trial. Here on the record, there is nothing that occurred that shows that appellant received anything but a fair trial. Indeed, really, the only issue at severance was whether or not the allegations or the specifications of charges involving the two litigated victims, so A1CS as well as Ms. JD, if those specifications would be separated from the specifications of which appellant was going to plead guilty to. And the primary concern as addressed by defense at trial was they were afraid of essentially a residual doubt if the members return a not guilty on the litigated specifications, that they would somehow increase the punishment for the guilty specifications, which he pled guilty. And that was the primary concern of the defense going in. And it seems, too, that while the defense motion and the military judge made a ruling regarding severing A1CS's charges from Ms. JD's charges, the appellant on the record specifically stated that he was not asking the two victims to be separated. That's the record at 219. And their primary concern, though, was with regard to moving the guilty specifications away from the not guilty specifications because of sentencing. But in the end, what happened was the appellant was found guilty of almost everything except for an Article 128 offense, and then he was sentenced for all the offenses by the same panel. And the panel was not aware that the appellant had pled guilty to many of the charges and specifications except for the two specifications that appellant had specifically requested the members be informed of. And they did that, and it's obvious why they did it, because they brought it up, appellant brought it up in voir dire and in opening, that they wanted to argue that, look, he's taken responsibility for these things. And they did argue that. In fact, It was so obvious that the military judge actually, in his spillover instructions, which he provided at numerous points during the trial, told the members to disregard that argument because they were not to consider those that he pled guilty to those offenses for anything. It had nothing to do with their findings relating to the not guilty specifications, the litigated specifications. And so you look at the test in Curtis of whether the evidence of one offense would be admissible to prove of the other, whether the military judge has provided proper limiting instructions, whether the findings reflect an impermissible crossover. And while the guilty plea specifications would not be admissible as proof of the other, the military judge denied trial counsel's motion under 404B, the members were never aware of those guilty pleas except for the two specifications that defense wanted them to know about and, in fact, used because they were consistent with their arguments of this being consensual behavior between the two parties. Also, the military judge found that with regard to A1C S as well as Ms. J.D. under 413, the evidence would have been admissible if you had severed those two charges, so there was no reason under test one to sever these charges. Whether the military judge provided proper limiting instructions, he did. In his ruling regarding severance, he stated that he was going to provide spillover instructions at numerous points during the trial, and indeed he did. He provided it in the initial panel in voir dire, to the second panel in voir dire. He provided it before opening, and then he provided it again at findings. So at numerous points in the trial, the military judge reminded the members that they were not to use his plea of guilty for anything related to the not guilty charges. And then whether the findings reflect an impermissible crossover, they do not. The members, in fact, returned a not guilty on the greater offenses of two specifications of charge three, of the two specifications charge three, and found him guilty of LIO, and they also fully acquitted him of the Article 128 offense regarding Ms. J.D. So, obviously, there is nothing in findings that reflects that there was an impermissible spillover.
Counsel, let me ask you, even during sentencing, if the judge had granted the request and severed these charges into two court-martials, wouldn't the results of court-martial one been admissible at court-martial two?
Absolutely. So there was no impact at sentencing as well, if they were to be severed. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, the military judge was correct in finding, beyond a reasonable doubt, that any possible UCI would not have an effect on the trial, and the appellant on appeal has not provided any additional information of why this finding should be changed or questioned by this court. This court can be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the findings of additional charge and guilty of Specification 1 and 2 of Charge 3 are legally and factually sufficient, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied the defense motion for severance. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With response, Your Honors, to the point of error 5 regarding the consent and the mistake of fact.
Let me talk with you for a moment about that, Mr. Gross. Viewing this entire case in its broadest context, I think we'd have to agree that Tech Sergeant Rodriguez cut a pretty broad swath, right? We've got a dozen or more individuals involved with him. And what I'm trying to seek to explore with you here is, does your client genuinely believe that, independent of anything to do with his rank and position, that he is such an irresistible love object that these women are all falling for him right and left? Or does he realize or understand that he might be playing a highly manipulative game in which his rank and position exert an extraordinary influence over these other individuals in getting what he wants? You understand the nature of my question?
I do, Chief Judge. And I think, let's just look at Airman S., for instance, B.S. She's receiving text messages from Jaime Rodriguez. They're sexual in nature. She never tells him to stop sending those text messages. In fact, she takes part in those text messages. I don't see any kind of action by Jaime Rodriguez regarding BS of any kind of pressures like that the government's alleged to. In fact, the day this allegedly happened, the two of them are out running. Airman S. and Jaime Rodriguez are out running together, and she doesn't go home to shower. She goes into the office with Jaime Rodriguez. I mean, if we look at this in the scope of all the facts in the case that we know about, she's consenting to all this action. And as the senior judge pointed out a little bit ago, there's kissing going on. She testified at page 873 of the record that she allowed the digital penetration of the genitalia. She testified page 917 of the record that her touching of his genitalia was foreplay.
Now, she also testifies, though, that she's concerned about this rap leave that she'll be authorized for as an authorized type of leave rather than being charged leave, and that she only continues these text messages with him until he finalizes the paperwork. She gets that paperwork in the system, and then she cuts off all connections with him. And so isn't that also evidence, though, that she is persuaded, enticed, coerced into engaging in these actions because of his superior rank and because of some influence he has over her military status and whether she'll be charged leave or not for these days?
The problem with BS, Your Honor, is with Airman S, is she's not consistent on this. You know, her Article 32 testimony was markedly different at times than her GCM testimony. In fact, the defense had to take her to task on that on cross-examination. And I don't think Airman S was consistent enough for this court, with all due respect, to draw that conclusion, Senior Judge, because she's not consistent enough.
Mr. Gross, is it your belief that Airman First Class S is utterly oblivious to Tech Sergeant Rodriguez's superiority in rank and power over her?
I think she's enjoying his company, Chief Judge. She's running with him. She's taking part in texting with him. She's kissing him. She's not telling him no to kissing her. I think she's enjoying his company, Chief Judge. And I don't mean to be presumptuous on this. I mean, I'm just trying to give what I think is a fair, objective as I can, reading of the record. I think, Chief Judge, she's enjoying his company, sir. That's honestly what I get from the gist of this. And then something happens where I don't know if, when the other 16 complainants came forward, if she started changing her mind on things, I'm not sure. But there are some problems.
I think you're addressing this, Mr. Gross, and I appreciate it. But when we come to the actual scene there in the office where the alleged events occur at that time, in that point in time, I didn't hear the government say it explicitly this way, but I think their argument is that we need to view this through an entirely different lens when you're talking about this rank and this setting than if they were high school teenagers going through the same factual scenario. I mean, that seems to be sort of an underlying point of their argument. How do you respond to that?
I don't view the atmosphere in that command as that type of atmosphere, Chief Judge. I don't view it as a very, very regimented, boot and polish, you know, spit and polish kind of atmosphere. A very, I'm on this side of the line, you're on this side of the line. You know, junior enlisted, you stay away from, the staff NCO. My reading of this record doesn't give me that kind of essence in the command or the relationship between Airman S and Jaime Rodriguez. I just don't see that, Chief Judge. Now, in some commands, I would agree with you. Some commands I was involved in the Marine Corps, I would agree 100%. What on earth are you doing? But an honest look at these facts on this, Your Honor, I don't see it being that kind of command, Your Honor. And I think
your perception is they're essentially on an equal footing in
yes,
romantic attraction.
Absolutely, Chief Judge. That's what I think. And I don't see her having any concerns about any kind of ratings by Tech Sergeant Rodriguez or anything like that. In fact, she testified when she wanted to leave, she was able to in that office deal. So I just don't see that it's the type of situation that the government is implying, based on the facts we have on this record. If I heard the government correctly, and I don't mean to put words in their mouth, I didn't hear everything they said real well, but it's if I heard correctly, they agree with the findings of fact of the military judge on the UCI issue, and that they had no qualms at all with the findings of fact or the conclusions of law by the military judge on this. If that's the case, then the facts do constitute apparent UCI, as the military judge found in findings of fact 48 and 50. In the Johnson case, I know, Senior Judge, you asked a little bit ago about that. In the Johnson case, that court said that a court member's oral assurance may not be sufficient to overcome that presumption. And that's what I was trying to get at with my cite to Holbrook versus Flynn. And in this particular case, I think it's significant because these answers by the 8 court-martial members that were selected on the panel are astonishing about their familiarity with the congressional investigations, with SecDef statements, president's statements, zero tolerance, and just how hot this issue was at Lackland Air Force Base back in the summer of 2013. It's
counsel,
our position.
Counsel, then why didn't defense counsel challenge all these members?
The record's bare on that, Senior Judge, and I don't think we can presume. The only thing in the record that touches on it, Senior Judge, is two things. One, the judge denied the UCI instruction. We only have one peremptory. We know that. We have unlimited cause. The other thing we know in the record, number two, is that the military judge acknowledged that the defense is probably concerned about the numbers game with the one-third, two-thirds. That's the only thing that's in the record that goes to it, and I don't think from a bare record we could glean, at least my reading of it, I can't glean counsel's thoughts on this. I think the counsel thought that the motion to dismiss for UCI was denied, and I think that counsel was relying upon the Rosser and Cruz cases where, you know, what they proved was, would a reasonable member of the public have a loss of confidence in the military justice system and believe this trial was unfair? I don't see how any reasonable member of the public could think anything but when this court-martial takes place 1 month and 1 day after the statements by the President and SECNAV and by these congressional hearings that were taking place. I think a reasonable member of the public would look at this and say, wow, what's the rush? Why do this right at the same time that these statements are taking place? The government counsel indicated when they first started they didn't think the military judge abused his discretion in denying the motion. And I don't think the court here thinks that that's the standard, but I just wanted to point out that abuse of discretion is not the standard on point of error one dealing with the UCI. It's a completely de novo review. This court, since it's constitutional error of a fair trial due process, has to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that UCI did not exist and affect the outcome of this case. And the government has not shown this court, they have not rebutted the presumption that Jaime Rodriguez was deprived of a fair trial as a result of the facts of this case. I see I'm out of time. I want to thank the court so much for giving me the opportunity to come up and give oral argument to the court. Thank you so much.
Mr. Gross and Major Damon, we'd like to thank you for your excellent arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All right.